Boom, what up? Hello, bonjour, and hola, real leaders. This is Kevin Edwards, your host here, and I am so excited you're tuning in to one of our amazing experiences. What you're about to hear is going to be fresh, real, and loaded with inspiration, guaranteed to support your impact journey. So sit back, enjoy the listen, folks, share a review afterward, and always keep it real. In 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Real Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Edwards, and alongside me today, folks, we have the formidable Jesse Henry, CEO of Heartland. Jesse, my man, pleasure to see you in full health here today.
Yes, thanks for having me. Formidable is quite the compliment. I appreciate it.
Well, for folks who do not know, Jesse did survive a crazy, car accident on the way to ReLeaders Unite. And he was just full of energy for the 3 days, continued to battle some adversity health-wise, and again, still standing and thriving here today, Jesse. So when I say it's a pleasure to see you, it really is. Jesse, where I want to start is a conversation we're having offstage. I want to bring it to the forefront here, the elephant in the room in manufacturing right now when it comes to scope 3 emissions, something that no one's talking about, that if we actually had a conversation, maybe we could actually make change in this world. What is that elephant in the room?
I think the elephant in the room is chemicals are either going to destroy our society or save our society. And we exist today in a $5 trillion materials industry. And every pound of those materials that moves, Kevin, has a really high carbon footprint. So it's really our duty and responsibility and obligation to figure out how do we reduce the negative impact that these materials have on the planet. And that's the responsibility of the manufacturing and the chemical sector to figure out how to do. Today, there's not a lot of solutions out there. So the chemical and the manufacturing industries, they need drop-in, high-performance, carbon-negative materials that can be produced at commodity scale at a commodity price point. Now, that's not easy because we've been relying on petroleum for a century. And so this materials transition will mirror very closely to the energy transition that we saw take place in the early 2000s. A lot of the Inflation Reduction Act focuses on supporting the decarbonization of raw materials. And I look forward to more legislation that will come in the future, but it's really the responsibility of the private sector to figure out how to decarbonize and how to lead the materials transition. And it's companies like Heartland who are really supporting the chemicals in the manufacturing sector as they try to figure out some of these more intermediate solutions that can help segue them to the material transition.
And for the layman listening out there, you know, hearing this for the first time, what has been the history of I guess the materials you're speaking about, mainly maybe virgin plastic or recycled, you know, materials. What's been the history with this and how did we get to this point?
Oh man, we got to this point through a series of people with a lot of money making a lot of big decisions. If you think about chemistry, you really have a bio-based chemistry and a petroleum-based chemistry. The reason why we chose petroleum as a society is because you tap into the ground and you seemingly have an unlimited resource right there. And it's a very simple chemistry. It's just hydrogen and carbon. So it's really easy to build up hydrogen and carbon into certain types of plastic. But when you have a bio-based chemistry, now you have hydrogen, carbon, and a bunch of other stuff. And so to get the bio-based feedstock into a hydrocarbon costs money. It takes energy to do that. And so the petroleum-based chemistries have won out over the past 100 years. Now we see as a society that pollution has caused all these problems beyond CO2. We talked about it before, mercury, arsenic, sulfur dioxide. There's all these problems on the planet that's being caused from the extraction of materials like oil. So it's really our duty as a society to figure out how do we become less reliant on oil and more reliant on bio-based feedstocks that can be regenerated on an annual basis.
And you say this is a call for the private sector to kind of drive this change. What is the issue about the public sector that's not capable of making this change? And how do you view that?
Man, your business model better not be reliant on the public sector making a decision yesterday, because it takes years for those things to happen. The private sector knows that scope three emissions make up a majority of their emissions. And when you look at scope three carbon emissions, which are the emissions up and down your supply chain, it's the really difficult ones to calculate. Scope one and two emissions are super simple. You take your energy bill and your gas bill, and there's your scope one and two emissions. Scope three emissions, a majority of those emissions are your materials. So if you're a manufacturer or a chemical company, decarbonizing your raw material supply chain is actually the most mission critical thing that you could focus on in order to hit any type of net zero target by 2050. What I focus on with customers is beyond carbon footprint. Carbon footprint is an important topic, but there's so many other externalities that we experience as a society from mining and petroleum-based resources that we need to start to look at in order for these companies to better understand how these new materials can make a positive impact on their supply chains.
And I think maybe a use case for people listening to this might help really bring some clarity to what you're talking about. You're in Detroit. Let's talk about the automobile industry. Of course, you know, everything from the shell of the car to the engine to the fuel it uses to the leather seats. These are all materials that are most likely virgin materials that they've used in the past for efficiency. What's been the use case here? I know Heartland's working with some vehicles. Tell me about maybe what's been traditionally done and how Heartland can also address this problem.
Yeah, so if you go back about 100 years, vehicles were mostly made of steel and different types of metals. And then as automobiles became commercially available, society started to realize, wait a minute, if we can reduce the weight of these vehicles, they can go further, they can go faster, they can go longer, they can get more fuel range or more fuel efficiency. And so the automobile industry started trying to figure out, wait, how do we replace these metals with plastics, polymers? And that was really where the revolution in lightweighting really took a foothold. Now today, we're in 2024. Look at every vehicle that comes off a production line. It looks like a spaceship. These are 5-star rated interior vehicles that we couldn't have even imagined 20 years ago. So now that everyone's got a spaceship looking vehicle, we're all sitting here like, how do we create a competitive advantage? So everyone's trying to figure out, how do we reduce the weight of the materials that we use in the vehicle? It's not just for fuel efficiency anymore. Now with the rise of the EV movement, now it's making sure that your range is higher and that there's no range anxiety from the customer, which is a little bit outside of our control. But most of the additives used in plastic are minerals like talc and calcium carbonate, or synthetic fibers like fiberglass or carbon fiber. All of these materials are really heavy. Most of them are pretty toxic to the human body. They have a pretty high carbon footprint. And so a natural fiber like hemp fiber can help reduce the cost, weight, and the carbon footprint of that plastic that's used in automotive component parts.
And so this is kind of obviously hemp's been around for a long time. And it used to be, if I'm not mistaken, like very prevalent. Like this used to be a hot commodity. Maybe share a little bit about the history of hemp and why you see hemp as a great solution.
Hemp is a solution, and it's the solution that we're using to solve a sustainability problem. So hemp for us is a vehicle to solve those sustainability problems, just like any other natural fiber. I mean, natural fibers, Kevin, have been used for 30 plus thousand years to reinforce things. 30,000 years ago, it was clay homes, and they would use things like straw or hay, and they would use that as a reinforcement to make the home more durable. And so we're just taking the science from tens of thousands of years ago and adapting it for precision manufacturing. Today, when you look at injection molding, there are such tight specifications in how they manufacture these goods today that you really need to make sure that you're manufacturing your bio-based feedstock in a way that can work for millions of units that are coming off of production lines. And so we use the hemp fiber as a carbon negative plastic additive to replace materials like fiberglass and talc.
Interesting. And so tell me a little bit more about hemp. Like, where do you source it from? Tell me about how it gets from A to B.
Yeah. So we're America's largest hemp fiber producer. Last year, we did about 15% of America's hemp fiber, 2,100 acres right in Southwest Michigan. In 2024, we'll do a little over 13,000 acres. So we're expanding production quite a bit. Our process really focuses on taking the hemp fiber, which comes to us in a baled format, and turning that into a plastic additive, which is in a pelleted format. So we recently got a patent on our process, which really covers how we mill, chemically pretreat, pelletize the natural fiber so that it can be effectively used in plastic, specifically to solve for performance problems like bonding, dispersion, and thermal stability.
Love it. And I assume that's been the issue with hemp from a commercial point of view in the past?
Yeah, so natural fibers don't mix well with plastic. If you can imagine the chemistry of a bio-based material and the chemistry of a petroleum-based material, they don't necessarily like each other. And so there's certain things that we need to do in order to get the bio-based materials into the petroleum-based materials. When you try to load it in a powdered format, you get a lot of problems with dust and flammability and moisture. And also, as I mentioned, bonding and dispersion and flammability become problems if you're not properly engineering the natural fiber in a way that it can bond and perform inside the plastic.
And just to kind of bring this full circle, how can you use a hemp fiber in a vehicle? Like, what does that look like?
So we're working with different automotive, both OEMs and tier one suppliers, on whole gamut of applications, interior applications, exterior applications, even industrial packaging, like plastic pallets used throughout their supply chain. We're looking at decarbonization opportunities that supersede the vehicle itself. These companies have very complicated supply chains. An OEM that makes a big pickup truck that you're probably familiar with, that pickup truck takes 30,000 component parts and 1,500 suppliers to make. So when we look at Ford or GM and say, well, these are the big automotive manufacturers, well, let's remember, they don't manufacture a lot of component parts. They source those component parts from tier one, two, and three suppliers. They assemble vehicles and they market those vehicles. And so it's really important to understand how these different manufacturers work within the supply chain. We've had to create these supply chain relationships. We're working with the brand, the converter, like an injection molder, and the plastic compounder who's making the actual composite that the injection molder and brand are using.
And Jesse, of course, you know, as you know, and as everyone, you know, here is probably been watching the show is aware of, is everything that we kind of see, what's behind the scenes, what you just described, it's very opaque, right? You kind of just, you see this car, it's here, like, what is the, I guess, return on investment or the, I guess, value proposition to use a hemp-based product? Is it to communicate that to the consumer? Is it cost savings? What is it to you?
For the brand owner, it's really cost, weight, and carbon footprint. They're looking to reduce the cost basis of their raw materials. Their cost of goods sold are always going up because they're making more vehicles, hopefully. And so they're looking for ways to control costs and reduce costs to the extent that they can. And there's a lot of supply chain uncertainties, both in the plastic industry and the plastic additive industry. And because these markets fluctuate, the price points of these materials end up fluctuating just like other commodities. And so for the brand owners, there's a lot of price insecurity, and they're trying to stabilize that by using alternative materials. Carbon footprint is obviously the elephant in the room that a lot of these manufacturers are trying to solve for and optimize for. What we help them better understand is how the materials that we manufacture at Heartland can help them solve for some of these other externalities that they might not be thinking about. For example, we grow this natural fiber in Michigan. So this is a Michigan grown crop, and all the impacts to farmers and the positive impacts to those farmers end up being in the hands of the brand owner that's 100 miles down the street. So the natural fiber that was grown in Michigan ends up being pelletized in Michigan, ends up being compounded in Michigan, ends up being injection molded in Michigan, and ends up in a vehicle that's assembled in Michigan, which is the story that we're really trying to create globally. I think all the big global multinationals are really missing the bigger picture. The story is local supporting local. So we've executed that in Michigan. We have other customers in other regions, both domestically and internationally, where we want to copy and paste that so that we can eventually be in Germany and grow natural fibers in Germany, pelletize them in Germany so that they end up in German vehicles in the future.
That's beautiful. And ultimately, is this to you kind of the conversation of, you know, is this trying to maximize shareholder value as opposed to stakeholder value? I mean, is that the conversation that's being had? And what do you think needs to change in order for, you know, publicly traded organizations to see the value in the value chain?
I think consumer demand is doing a big job at starting that change. But if you look at all the stakeholders that are providing pressure to these large organizations now, it's no longer just customers saying, hey, I want a sustainable product. It's investors in these public companies. It's governments. It's the actual employees who work at the companies. There's a lot of research on Gen Z, how they won't work for a company that doesn't align to their values. Well, if your employees have a sustainability-focused mindset, then the company's more apt to get into the innovations in material science. Today, a lot of companies have a strong thesis around energy and how to decarbonize their energy. There's solar, there's wind, there's carbon credits or energy credits. Those are all widely available today. It's really about solving for this elephant in the room, which is we have a raw material supply chain that's very carbon intensive, and we need to decarbonize that supply chain, and we need reliable strategies to do it, not just hoping that recycled plastic gets us there.
Right. And the hope is transparency continues to increase and consumer education continues to increase. So we can change the narrative. Of course, it is a big hope. But, you know, Jesse, you're a very well-versed individual, very well-versed gentleman right here. I would love to kind of learn a little bit about your background. Like, what inspired you to look into this issue? Like, what inspired you to tap into sustainability and specifically hemp?
Man, I hated every career that I did when I was younger. I'm too young to have as many careers as I've had at this point. I think when I look back on it now, it's easier to understand and see. But, you know, I was in investment banking and I just realized one day the world doesn't need another investment banker. And so I went on a long walk and did some soul searching. And I said, what do I really care about? And sustainability was a theme. And I didn't know what that looked like. And it took a lot of pivots to get to where I'm at today. But when I look back at it, my grandpa was in the glass fiber industry. His father was in the natural fiber industry, importing woolen tops from Europe. So I'm really kind of completing also a family story here in the natural and synthetic fiber space. And I really do believe today that we need intermediate solutions. When we started Heartland, we wanted to start it as a bioplastic company. So what I do, I go start calling brands and try to sell bioplastic to companies that buy a lot of plastic. And I was laughed at every room, Kevin. It was what I wanted the solution to be, but it wasn't what the market was asking for. The market was asking for something that's at price parity. You can't buy a petroleum-based plastic today for 50 cents and a bio-based plastic for $2. It's not realistic. It's actually not sustainable to do that, regardless of the carbon footprint, because no company's willing to increase their COGS by 200-400%. And so we pivoted into plastic additives from the bioplastic space and immediately started seeing traction because we were able to do it at price parity. So I think these organizations need a lot of things. Carbon footprint is one of them, but they need price, they need performance, they need weight. And given that weight, cost, and performance hit, then sustainability becomes icing on the cake. But for companies who are looking to get into the space, if you're leading with sustainability and hoping that sustainability is the silver lining and your saving grace, you need to start focusing on how your material performs, what your material is priced at, the scale that you can grow this material to. Because if you're not taking into account those things, it doesn't matter how sustainable your material is.
And so tell me, so you search for a solution that the market was asking for, but of course you can't just, you probably didn't have enough cash to plant an entire field of hemp, and you probably had to raise some capital. Like, what was your experience with raising capital to build this supply chain of natural fibers?
Yeah, it's been a bloodbath. I'll put it that way. We've for 4 years worked off of a very low budget, mostly with angel investors. We did have a small USDA grant. We did get a small bank loan, so there was some other help out there. We've recently closed capital with a large chemical company, and this is the first institutional capital that we're bringing into the company. We're very excited about it.
Congrats, yeah.
Because it's institutional capital, but also because we're kind of sitting at the intersection of the revolution in this industry, which is decarbonized materials. And this is the largest chemical company on the planet. And so the stamp of approval from them is really an industry validator, not just about hemp fiber, but that natural fibers are viable solutions in the plastic space.
So so I'm hearing you right. You went to, would this be like another manufacturer with like this, yeah, that you went to for financing that they, okay, interesting. Yeah, so creative finance.
They, They manufacture different types of chemicals. They do over 100 billion pounds of chemicals a year. We're working specifically on component parts in the automotive space with very specific suppliers. And we're working on a natural fiber and glass fiber filled nylon. Now, nylon, from consumer standpoint, they know it because it's in their Lululemon pants or it's in some piece of clothing that they bought. Nylon is very commonly used in the automotive space. It's a very durable plastic. It's very high performance plastic. And we figured out how to replace all the mineral additives that are in this specific nylon from this specific chemical supplier by using a carbon negative additive. So we've been able to reduce the cost basis significantly. We've been able to reduce the weight significantly. And that weight savings is rippling into the cost savings of the tier one automotive supplier and the brand owner.
Makes a lot of sense. So some corporate financing here. And I'm sure they're, again, like you just mentioned, they're bringing a lot of valuable resources on top of just cash. So that's really interesting. Tell me, like, so far in this, just this past year, like, what have been some of the key learnings from whether it's the raise, the team building, the traction? I mean, a lot of people kind of see companies that's just always going up, but in reality, they're going up and down every day, yeah, every month. So tell me about what you've learned so far this year.
Man, you can't lose if you don't give up. I think that's a big one. And I think the universe is constantly reminding me of that. I think one of the other things I think of, Kevin, is everyone wants to sit in the king's throne till there's a sword dangling 2 inches from their throat. Everyone wants it. They want the nice car, all the money. They want the praise. They want to be the industry leader, yada, yada, yada. What they don't want to do is all the work required to get all those outcomes. And so I say that tongue in cheek, could be a queen's throne instead of a king's throne, right? Very inclusive here. But I do think that people want the praise. They don't want to work for it. They just want the outcome. And you really see the type of person you are and the type of person your team is when you're inches from death and there's a sword right next to your throat and you're able to pull it through.
It's certainly resonating for me, and I know will resonate for a lot of other business leaders listening to this as well. And of course, people are always the most difficult part of running a business. What do people say? It's like running a business is easy, managing people is hard. What's been your experience from a management lens so far about, you know, finding the right people, but also because, like, you really don't know someone until you coach them or mentor them or manage them, right? Yeah. What's been your experience with this difficult journey so far?
So I'm very blessed. My business partner is extremely resilient. I mean, this guy is even keeled. I'm the one that rides the roller coaster wave. So I'm up when I'm up and I'm down when I'm down. He's been a rock for me. So I really appreciate him. I think two things that I look for, Kevin, are coachability and work ethic. If you have a good work ethic and you're coachable, I can work with you. But if you don't have those two skill sets, it becomes increasingly difficult. We work in the chemical sector. There's a very technical language that needs to be spoken, and I've tried to kind of simplify it in this conversation. But in order to come on board in sales or marketing, you need to understand these concepts of chemistry and manufacturing. You need to understand how raw material supply chains work, how product development's done, the different performance properties required for the applications that we're going into. And this is a little more nuanced than maybe selling a consumer product. And so if someone doesn't have coachability and they don't have work ethic, there's not much I can do for them. If they have those two skill sets and they're willing to learn, and they really care about what we're doing here, the sky's the limit.
Let's talk a little bit specifically as we continue to talk about more about leadership. Like, tell me, core values is something that, you know, we as leaders often think about, whether it's our own core values or it's the company. Do you believe in establishing core values? If so, would you mind sharing them with the company and how they get used?
Yeah. So core values for Heartland: education, innovation, and collaboration. Those are the three that we chose. About 3 years ago, I circulated a memo, not just internally, but to some of the advisors that we had. And I said, hey, here's how I'm thinking through the mission, the vision, the values, the purpose of the company. What do you guys think here? And really, they challenged me to simplify. They said, if you can't explain it to someone else, then it's too complicated. It's kind of the game of telephone. So I really tried to simplify everything down to a few words. The Heartland values are, you know, maybe slightly different from my personal values and things I look for in my relationships, which are a bit different. But I've really worked to make sure Heartland's values are easy to communicate and easy to understand and are meaningful based on the purpose and the intention that we have in the marketplace.
And as the vision of Heartland continues to grow and change, like, how do you communicate that to the team? Are you often talking about where we're going? What's been helpful in terms of influencing and driving change within the organization?
You definitely have to beat the same drum over and over again. It can sound repetitive, but someone has to repeat the mission and make sure everyone's on the same page. If you got someone swimming in this direction and someone swimming in that direction, it's really hard to get the outcomes that you're looking for. And as a new material in a very conservative industry, everyone's got to be singing the same song and doing the same dance. Because if we're not, then we're being counterproductive and divergent. So it is really important to re-communicate the mission, vision, values, purpose. What I find is that these things are always evolving, that I'm finding new ways to communicate things every single day and every single call I get on. I'm asking different questions and getting different feedback from people. So it's a very lean startup methodology where there's a consistent feedback loop on a day-to-day basis. And based on the feedback that I'm getting, I'm able to better articulate Heartland's narrative and message because I'm seeing how it resonates in the minds of the people that I'm trying to work with.
There's this old business maxim of whatever gets said or gets measured, gets paid attention to and gets done. Do you have a management process or an accountability chart or a system that has been working for you, whether it's EOS and traction? It could be something just simple KPIs, OKRs. What's been working for you?
We could probably get better at this, Kevin. We do use KPIs to manage internally. Obviously, our production scheduling takes a lot of management, both on the production of the natural fiber itself and the production of the natural fiber pellets that the customer ends up using. Acreage is a super important metric for us and expanding acreage. And then volume of any given customer. We need to understand, is this a 100 billion pound a year chemical company? Or is this an injection molder that buys 3 million pounds of plastic a year? And really understanding that is super important. I'd say the secret sauce in the material innovation space is understanding how to shorten your sales cycle. And that is a leading indicator of your ability to get your material into the marketplace. A lot of material innovations, Kevin, these things take 5+ years. I mean, you're talking about automotive. You want to replace a door panel? You want to be on an exterior component part? You want to be in a car bumper? Man, you're going to be collecting Social Security if you don't properly manage your sales process the right way. So it's really important to always be asking yourself and your team, how do we shorten the sales cycle here? How do we shorten the sustainable material innovation timeline? And for us, that's supporting our customers with formulation, with processing conditions, maybe even sometimes with sending them a natural fiber filled plastic instead of sending them the natural fiber additive. So it could speed up the amount of time it takes to really test and validate if this material could potentially work for them.
And if I recall from our session many years ago, Sustainable Brands, doesn't hemp have like a shorter like life cycle? Like, doesn't it?
Yeah,
like a couple yields? Yeah.
Grows really quickly. It grows in 90 days. You grow it anywhere on the planet. It also happens to remove more CO2 than any other agriculture feedstock. So we have a lot of benefits going for us there. What we have going against us
is
the name hemp, right? Is the word hemp, which is A, part of our biggest weakness, and B, part of our biggest strength, which has been frustrating to navigate over the years. But yeah, 100 years ago, like the USDA came out and said, hemp is the future of commodity row cropping, right? That it's going to be added in every, you know, corn and soybean and wheat rotation on the planet. Getting a new crop or a new agriculture product into the agriculture industry is its own beast of a problem to tackle. And I'll admit my partner Tim's done an incredible job doing that. It takes a lot of money and a lot of resources to integrate a new crop into farming rotations. So while Tim's working on the supply side of the business and the farming, processing, distribution, storage, I'm working on the demand side of the business and sales and marketing, making sure that manufacturers and chemical companies, A, know who we are, and B, how we can help them.
It makes a lot of sense. And that's really cool that you guys have kind of figured out that, you know, dynamic that which every good business needs. Maybe a question that might be for Tim, but the cash management's got to be really on. Like, you got to be spot on in that kind of business. Like, have you run into any challenges with cash management because of the just the nature of the business?
Yeah, managing these types of companies is interesting because we're bridging three main industries: agriculture, chemicals, and manufacturing, all of which are super conservative industries. Mm-hmm. These are not typically considered progressive industries. So we're working with pretty conservative people where carbon footprint might not be the first thing that comes to mind when they think about the innovations that they're focused on in their space. So cash management on the agriculture side is super important. If you also look at some of the largest chemical companies on the planet, they're not run by a material scientist or a mechanical engineer. They're run by a finance guy. And the reason why they're run by a finance guy is because you're floating some of the world's largest manufacturers on net 90 terms. And so you're always trying to extend your payables and shorten your receivables, which is like the most basic strategy on the planet. That can be quite difficult when we're managing the agriculture side, the processing side, and the chemical side, where payment terms from the chemicals companies might not line up with what we're seeing on the manufacturing or agriculture side.
Yeah, that's a juggernaut. It seems pretty complex, but you know, someone's got to do it. Changing kind of gears here, if you will, a question I want to ask you, and this might be, is very synonymous with real leadership, but real conversations. Gonna put you on the spot here. What is the most difficult conversation that you've had to have as an entrepreneur? First thing that comes to mind.
I'd say conversations with my business partner and money being the focus. I think every startup faces these challenges, and unless you're OpenAI raising $7 trillion to solve, you know, XYZ problem, most startups are underfunded and overworked. They got to figure out how to do more with less. And on one side, that's been a strategic competitive advantage, right? We had a small budget for agriculture last year. How do we figure out how to do 2,100 acres off a tiny budget? Well, that took a lot of hard conversations, but also some innovation and trying new things that my business partner was promoting. Hey, we should try these things because we have XYZ budget, but we need ABC outcome. Mm-hmm. How do we manage both? And so understanding how to do more with less, I think, is super important. That's on the supply side of the business. On the demand side of the business, one of the strategies that I dove deep in a few years ago was SEO, search engine optimization. I wanted to figure out, what are material scientists thinking? What do they type into Google? What do mechanical engineers type into Google? What does someone who leads an R&D department of a Fortune 500 company type into Google? And how do we reverse engineer those keywords and write content to support what they're looking for? And so, you know, off a $0 marketing budget, we compete with $50 billion companies in search because we got really innovative and scrappy on our SEO strategy. So I'd say the toughest conversations are, you know, lack of financial resources, and the interim solutions are, how do we do more with less?
It makes a lot of sense. Of course, you know, any CEO, your main role is to maximize the return on the time and scarce resources that you have. A question for you, when it comes to growth in your experience, what have been like some of the keys to growth for this company?
Man, this journey, and I'm sure this answer would be different for my business partner, but this journey has taught me a lot. And most notably, when I was very early on in this journey, I was very reductionistic. It was all about carbon footprint. And, you know, our real vision was to become Earth's most sustainable company by replicating supply chains of carbon negative materials. And so everything was CO2. The only reason production volumes mattered was, you know, how much carbon we get to remove. And Heartland is a great LCA. Every 1 pound of our hemp fiber removes 2.85 pounds of CO2, which is like a pretty strong LCA in the materials market. Most plastics take between 2 and 8 pounds of CO2 to create. So to have an additive that's negative 2.85 really helps reduce the negative impact of those chemicals. But I had an advisor, I'd say 2 or 3 years ago, who, you know, told me on a call, he's like, Jess, he's like, you're so focused on carbon footprint. How can you integrate sustainability into other parts of your life? How do you show up in your relationships? What's the food that you're eating? What are the chemicals you're using in your day-to-day life? This is like a very eye-opening experience for me, right? I'm so reductionistic, trying to solve a global problem and just focusing on carbon footprint, thinking that that's the answer, when I need to be looking in the mirror and saying, hey, what am I eating? Or what are the chemicals I'm using on my skin, like my deodorant or my toothpaste or my face wash or my conditioner or the hand soap that I use? So I went on this journey and I changed every chemical I use. I changed all the food that I ate, changed the clothes that I wear. And I really dove deep into the question of how can I integrate sustainability into other areas of my life beyond carbon footprint? And I think this kind of speaks to what we were speaking about before, is like our society is so focused on CO2 that we have blinders on. We're missing all these other externalities that are super, super important in our society because it's not a conversation about CO2.
Well said, and not just talking about being about it is what I'm gathering here as well. Jess, this has been like an awesome conversation today. So the last question we ask everyone that comes on this show is, in all of this, what is your definition of a real leader?
A real leader is someone who acts with a future in mind. And I think it's important to keep that answer short, sweet, and simple. And I'm sure you get a lot of different answers to that. But if you're not acting with the future in mind, what are you acting for? Your personal wallet, your paycheck for this week, followers on Instagram or likes? I think people who are acting with the future in mind are the leaders that we need, both in the public sector and the private sector.
Well said. For Jesse Henry, I'm Kevin Edwards, asking you to go out there, act with the future in mind, and always keep it real. Thanks, Jesse.
Thanks, Kevin.
Hey, Real Leaders, thanks again for listening to this amazing episode. And if you're someone like me who goes all the way to the end just to make sure I can extract as much information, education, and inspiration out of every single interview, might I suggest you check out our magazine. If you go online to realleaders.com today, you're going to get the first 30 days for free, where you're going to be able to access all of our magazines, courses, and live events from some of the top thought leaders around the world. All you have to do is go online to realleaders.com and click the subscribe button in the top right corner to get your free 30-day trial right now. Again, that's real-leaders.com. Thanks again for being a real leader, and always keep it real.